Hey, welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Evan Brand. Today's interview is with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick. He's a GP, and he's written a lot of books about cholesterol. He's been on various podcasts that you may know, and now he's here to talk with us about a book he wrote that I enjoyed called The Clot Thickens, The Enduring Mystery of Heart Disease. And if you're in your 30s, your 40s, you may hear that and go, meh, why should I care about heart disease? But the reality is, with the virus and with the injections, I'm seeing a lot of weird things show up on lab testing that I didn't see 5 years ago. So this is an important conversation for all of us. And you'd be surprised to know that vitamin C comes in to save the day and is an incredible tool against protecting your system. So with that, I would like to plug my hydration essentials. We just got a new batch in, sold out of those quickly last time. Thanks so much for your support. We have more in stock now. It's a lemon orange flavor. There's no sugar. This has potassium, your sodium chloride, magnesium, vitamin C, ribose, taurine, citrus bioflavonoids, quercetin, and rutin. My wife is drinking some as we speak. We just got back from a walk in the hot, humid sun, and there's nothing better to refuel yourself than just electrolytes. Like, sometimes cold spring water, it'll kind of do the job, but when you add those electrolytes to it, you just feel so much better, so much more energy. You just don't crash after exercise when you have good quality electrolytes in. So that's my advice. Try out the hydration essentials. You can get that using the link in the show notes, or you can go to the site Aura Roots, A-U-R-A Roots, R-O-O-T-S.com. That is my professional supplement company that we've used thousands of times for people around the world. Also, I was going to do a video this morning, got too busy to do it. I'll do it later. But my digestive enzymes are an incredible tool as well. So if you're someone who is trying to build muscle, you're trying to maintain muscle mass, you're trying to stay as fit as possible, you need to make sure you're actually digesting what you're eating. This idea of you are what you eat is only half the story. The real story is you are what you digest. And that's, unfortunately, a very compromised thing for most people. And I look at a lot of stool tests every day and every week, and I see that most people have low pancreatic enzyme function. They have H. pylori. They have other bacteria that disrupts the normal breakdown of food. And you're supporting your neurotransmitters, your hormones, your mood, all by fixing the hypochlorhydria state, which is that low stomach acid state that happens with stress, with age, and infections. So the Pure Digest is our blend. It's a proprietary blend of enzymes along with betaine, HCL, to support optimal digestion of your proteins, your fats, your carbs. Simply take one or two caps per meal. You'll feel way better. You shouldn't feel heavy. You shouldn't feel tired after you eat. You should be able to eat like I did. I had a New York strip steak and some blueberries. It was phenomenal after my workout, and I took the enzymes with it, and I feel so good. I'm not slowed down by that food. And so that's a good sign that you're at an adequate level of enzyme supplementation. So check out the Pure Digest. And then last thing, then we'll get into the show, betterbellycourse.com. Welcome to all the new students. I lowered the price significantly. I want to get as many people as I can in 2024 into this, where you'll get access to give or take 75 videos. You'll have interactive quizzes in each module. You'll get all of my future updates. You'll get a lot of mold and mycotoxin bonuses. You'll get access to my Candida Summit and much, much more. Steeply discounted that. Betterbellycourse.com. You can access that. You'll get immediate access to all of the training. You'll be able to see before and after case studies. I'll show you exactly what to do, how to fix your issues based on your labs. Lab tests are not included, but we're happy to run labs for you at any point. If you've already had labs, great. Just dive in. Get into the coursework. So that's betterbellycourse.com. Learn how to resolve your digestive, your mood, your skin issues. Even if you've suffered for decades, you're going to see incredible success. I actually just had a functional neurologist email. He's like, hey, I want to be a student. We got him in. So I love all the practitioners that are reaching out to get into this program as well. And this is something that took me literally a decade of experience to build based on seeing the worst of the worst in the functional medicine practice. So lastly, if you need one-on-one help, evanbrand.com. You can reach out and schedule a 15-minute free call with me. I'll chat with you. It's typically on a Monday. I'll chat with you for 15 minutes. I'll listen to what's going on, and I'll give my best advice and see if I can help. So feel free to book that. I'd love to hear what's going on. All right, take good care, and let's get into the show with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick. Hey, Dr. Kendrick, thanks for joining me.
No problem. Hope we have a nice chat this evening, or evening for me anyway, because I'm ahead of you in time.
Absolutely. Well, I've interviewed Dr. Mercola several times. I think Mercola did an interview with you first, is probably how I found you. And it was on the topic of your book, which is titled The Clot Thickens, The Enduring Mystery of Heart Disease. And I just got done reading it this morning and I loved it. And it really confirmed a lot of suspicions that I had about heart disease. I've read many other books on cholesterol, cholesterol myth, and a friend of mine, Jack Wolfson, wrote a book all about cholesterol and how really it's not as big of a deal as we make it out to be in the conventional medicine world, and the statins don't appear to be the answer. And I thought, well, what the hell is happening? Because if you look at the rates and you look at toxicity, you look at chemicals and pesticides, like everything just kind of matches up on this like hockey stick. And so your book really opened my eyes, and I have so many fun annotations and highlights from your book. The one was about lead. I want to cut straight to that, because this was really mind-blowing. And I've seen a lot of heavy metal testing through urine and through blood, and I rarely find a human that is not filled with metals, not only just lead, but mercury, cadmium, arsenic, aluminum. And now, what you have here, this was page 115 in the book, at least according to the Kindle. Lead toxicity can increase the risk of coronary vascular disease death by more than 700%. Yeah. That's pretty mind-blowing. Have you looked at other metals too, or was lead bad enough that you're like, hey, that's good enough for me?
Well, I have looked at other metals, but there comes a point where if you discuss too many things, it just becomes a blur, I think. So I focused in on lead, and yes, it was interesting to me as well. I mean, that came from off the top of my head. I think that was something like JAMA, this wasn't sort of some weird, you know, outer Mongolian journal of nonsense. So, not that I necessarily think everything in a mainstream big journal is true, but yes, there doesn't seem to be anything to contradict that. And, you start thinking, well, lead, well, why is that causing increased rates of heart disease? And it starts to fit in with other things. So I see no evidence to say that figure is wrong. Obviously, that's looking at people who have really got a lot of lead on board rather than people who don't have much lead on board. So it can increase the risk by that sort of factors, which is, pretty mind-blowing for many people. And when we say, I have people that I know quite well who are like cardiologists who go, oh, well, air pollution can't cause such problems as you say. And I say, well, the evidence is really strong. It's amazing that people don't pay any attention to this. It's just like, there you go. It's a fact.
You know, one thing I probably should have done and I haven't yet is to look at a map of India. Yeah. And coronary vascular disease, because I mean, you've probably seen this yourself, but the air pollution map that you can view of the planet, I mean, India has terrible, terrible air pollution pretty much year round. Have you looked at India specifically just to see how bad their air pollution is and match it to the coronary deaths?
No, I haven't either. I know that China has also got areas of terrible air pollution, and their rates of heart disease are rising quite rapidly, as they are in India. I think India is currently, I'll probably be wrong on this because things change all over the place. I think India's got one of the most rapid rises in heart disease of any country in the world. They used to run pretty low, and now they're running pretty hot. So, it would fit. I haven't specifically, laid one on top of the other.
I see one right here. Let's just look at this for fun. We'll do it on the fly because that's the way I do it. And so here's a picture. This is from Journal of American College of Cardiology is where this is from. This is, let's see if there's any years on this. Okay, 1990 to 2016.
Bingo.
So there's heart disease on the bottom left. And then we've got stroke on the bottom right. We've got, it's hard for me to see. Okay, here we go. So annual percentage change, that's what I'm looking for. So I don't know exactly what this reference range is, but I mean, it's gone crazy.
Yeah, well, as you can see, a lot of several countries, unfortunately, once you become rich, in the process of becoming a rich country, you go through some pretty horrific health problems. It's just a fact that that's happened. Obviously, they've taken lead out of almost all what they call gas in the US and petrol in the UK. I think it happened earlier in the US than it did in the United Kingdom. I think off the top of my head, they stopped putting lead into gas in the late 1960s in the States, whereas they didn't do that in the UK until about 1980 something. Wow. which is amazing that they kept going for so long,
isn't it? I know. Here's this too. This is from that same paper, cardiovascular disease in India compared with the United States. And then I just look quickly down here at the numbers. And so they're saying CVD per 100,000.
Yeah.
So now they're saying there's in 2016, which that's pretty old. That's almost 10 years old now. They're saying here, it looks like 54.6 million cases versus United States, 33 million. Could that be right? That India, well, I guess they have a major, much larger population.
Their population is about three times that of the UK, of the US. So if you match it, it's probably running around about the same in that case, I would have thought.
Yeah, here
so
we
it's,
go.
Yeah.
155 to 209 per 100,000 between 1990 and 2016.
Whereas in most countries, such as the US, those rates have been falling, as they have in the UK and most of, in fact, the countries that have the highest rates of cardiovascular disease now are actually usually ex-Soviet Union countries like Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and all those countries ending in Stan that you don't quite know what they are or who lives there. But their rates are astonishingly high. Yeah. And Russia itself has got very high rates as well.
And in the book, you document that because of a lot of like turmoil and like economic stress and stuff in those countries, right?
Yes. No, I think that economic turmoil, societal upheaval is very damaging to people, many people. It really knocks their defenses down and raises various hormones up that are quite damaging to people. But also in the Soviet Union, the pollution and the use of heavy industries was dreadful. So that plays a part as well, I'm sure. So it's I think if there's one message that I try and get across is this isn't one thing. it's a lot of things that add together. And once you reach a kind of crisis point or cut point, if you've got, say, five things that are going wrong at the same time, you're in trouble. If you've only got one thing or two things that are going wrong, your body can probably cope with that. But there comes a point where the kind of the load of, you know, pollution, lead, social stresses, you know, smoking, drinking, blah, 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 diabetes, eventually your body just says, that's it, I'm out of here. I can't deal with this any longer, and that's when things really start to go wrong in all sorts of different ways. Yeah,
yeah, well said. And I tell people that too when I'm trying to help them clinically. I tell them, look, if you're looking for a practitioner to give you a silver bullet, this one shot fix to depression, anxiety, blood pressure problems, whatever, it's not going to happen. And you lay that out in the book about 20 plus, maybe even up to 200 different variables and factors, everything from the heavy metals, the pesticides, other chemicals, even blood sugar. I noted some stuff down here about blood sugar, which was amazing to see, which is that you said here that in terms of the mechanisms, so diabetes or even pre-diabetes is in driving the coronary vascular disease because of, and you lay this out here, reduced nitric oxide synthesis, endothelial damage, increased blood coagulability, and then a reduction in circulating endothelial, is that pronounced progenitor cells?
Yeah, and endothelial progenitor cells are produced in the bone marrow. They're fascinating things. They were only discovered in the 1990s. Basically, your endothelium lines all of your blood vessels around your body. They're thin, flat shape. Well, they're sort of like tiles, except they're vastly more complicated than a tile. And if they get damaged or stripped off, for many years, people thought that what happened was that other endothelial cells kind of grew in from the outside and covered over the area of damage, and then realized that that doesn't happen at all. What happens is an endothelial progenitor cell produced in the bone marrow if it spots an area of damage in a blood vessel, it sticks to it. That area, it grows to a fully adult size of endothelial cell, and a whole bunch of them do this, and you create a new layer. So it's like having a bunch of tile repairmen floating around and just placing new tiles on your blood vessels and then covering them over. And then, of course, that's then the part of the repair mechanism is to produce new tiles. As I say, I use the analogy sometimes that if you think of a road, they lay the road, it's new, it's nice, and it's fine. And then after a while, it rains and cars come and trucks come, and you eventually end up with potholes all over the place. And if you never, ever repair that, these potholes become enormous and gigantic, and you can't even use the road anymore. Whereas if you have repair teams come along and resurface it, it remains sort of smooth and functional. And that's a bit like what's happening in our blood vessels. There's damage going on all the time, and there's repair going on all the time. And part of the repair system is these endothelial progenitor cells. And if you don't have enough of them, or you do things that suppress them. So stress hormones such as steroids or cortisol suppress endothelial progenitor cell production. And so the repair system is hampered. And therefore, it's not really that you're causing more damage. It's that when damage is caused, the system doesn't come to repair it. And then, of course, the endothelium itself is covered by a kind of grass lawn, if you like, or glycocalyx, it's called, which is a glucose protein strands and fibers that contain anticoagulant substances and all sorts of things. Nitric oxide is manufactured in the glycocalyx. And this is a remarkable substance. And if you start to thin this, so what blood sugar does is it thins the glycocalyx and causes the endothelium at the cells underneath to become exposed to the stuff going through the blood and the mechanical damage that can be caused. So the glycocalyx is your kind of first line of defense. And one thing that high blood sugar levels and stress hormones themselves and insulin itself actually damages the glycocalyx, which allows, if you like, more toxic things to happen to the endothelial cells. They're more easily damaged, they're more easily ripped apart and fall off, and at which point you start to develop blood clots at those points. And that's kind of, very simplistically, that's the process that's going on all the time in your body right now.
Wow. Yeah, it is fascinating that glycocalyx, is that how you pronounce it?
It's how I pronounce it. I don't think I've ever heard anyone else pronounce it, actually. Yeah. I read it a lot. It's a bit like in medicine. You read a word and think, how would you pronounce that?
Yeah.
I pronounce it glycocalyx. Maybe somebody, an expert, calls it glycolyx.
Yeah. It was fascinating. Yeah. So we should talk about the drugs, too, because these are things that not only do they kill people just because of just standard usage, but, I mean, these are going to be affecting not only your kidneys, but then also it seems like this is actually worsening your risk of vascular disease. And that's just simple stuff that people have in their cupboard right now, which could be the anti-inflammatory drugs. You write about ibuprofen and naproxen.
Yes.
And I read something like 18, 19,000 people die per year from ibuprofen. I believe it's probably due to stomach bleeding or maybe some other issue. I forgot the mechanism there.
But yeah.
Let's talk about that, because you know, even at the dental office, I mean, you'll go in and they'll just say, hey, let's give you some ibuprofen. Maybe a one-off dose like that's, you would say, not a terrible idea, but like a chronic back pain that's leading you to daily ibuprofen or something, you're going to get in big trouble.
Yeah, these are very commonly prescribed drugs. And one of the main problems that they have is they actually, ironically, because they were kind of developed because aspirin, which is an anti-inflammatory and is used for the same sort of purposes, an anti-inflammatory, actually it makes your blood less likely to clot. It all gets complicated and biochemical. But the newer ones, the naproxens and the ibuprofens and the whatever they call them in the States, the Voltaren, Diclofenac, increase blood clotting, and they also can damage the glycocalyx as well. So there is an increased risk of using these things long term. It definitely is there, and it definitely exists. And of course, if you're talking about millions and millions of people taking something for years and years, it doesn't take much of an increased risk to talk about thousands of and tens of thousands of of increased deaths. So I wouldn't like to frighten people off and say never take an anti-inflammatory medication ever again in your life, but I would definitely be cautious about using them. And of course, ironically, the drugs that are used to protect the stomach, because these drugs also have an effect on the stomach and cause bleeding in the stomach because they erode the lining of the stomach. So drugs that are used, that what they call the PPIs, the proton pump inhibitors. I think they call here they're called the metrazole, lansoprazole. Not quite sure how they're sold in the States under what name, but they also have another adverse effect, which is that they block nitric oxide synthesis. So they also, through that mechanism, increase damage to the lining of the arteries. And again, the risk is not huge, but if you're taking it for years and years, and especially if you're taking anti-inflammatories plus a PPI, you're doubling up on everything. So, you know, they're not really, it's not really, if you asked 100 doctors, you went to 100 doctors and said, oh, there's naproxen and diclofenac and omeprazole and lansoprazole and pantoprazole and whatever the Pepcid, do they increase the risk of heart disease? They'll look at you as if you're mad and go, no, they don't. But actually, they do. And that all the studies that you can see say that they do. And yet, this is unknown for most people. And you say, it is weird how some things gain such a lot of credence, isn't it? And such a lot of noise. And everyone runs around going, oh my God, we can't take this. We're all going to die. And yet, we've got other drugs everyone's taking. And I'm rushing around going, you can't take these all the time. You're going to die. And everyone looks at you and goes, shut up. We're talking about this. I'm going, it's a bit like with lead. They just look at you and they go, well, that doesn't matter. I'm going, you know, that same paper showed that during a period of about 30 years, more people died from lead toxicity, we call it, not poisoning, and due to cardiovascular disease, potentially up to 400,000 people. You know, and yet it's like, Oh well, never mind. It is remarkable how you find that some things worry people and other things don't. And the things that worry people are often a very small risk, and the things that don't worry people are often a very high risk. It's just that they haven't been publicized or people haven't run around screaming and yelling about them for long enough, and no one gives a damn that it's happening. And it's sort of interesting in a psychological point of view, but very frustrating from a scientific point of view, you know.
Oh, tell me about it. I deal with that all the time. I mean, I see it just with mold. You wrote about kidney disease in the book as well. And I had a man in his 70s from Canada, and he was diagnosed with chronic kidney disease. They said he was stage 4, and the nephrologist said, well, this is a progressive disease. You need to go ahead and get on the kidney transplant list. There's nothing we can do here. Get ready for dialysis and all of that. And yeah. I just happened to run his urine for mold because his daughter was actually working with me as well. And she had a big problem with mold in her home. And so did the father. And so we measured his levels and he was off the chart. And we know that a lot of those toxins affect the kidneys. And so I thought, well, I'm not a nephrologist, but I'm going to give you every, you know, herbal medicinal mushroom I've read in the literature to help the kidney function. And then we're going to use activated charcoal and other things to detox the mold. And sure enough, his kidney levels improved. His GFR got back to normal, such in a way that the nephrologist said, this must be an anomaly with the lab. This doesn't happen. This is progressive. Yeah. This is impossible. And we said, okay, you know, do the protocol 3 more months. We ran the GFR again. The kidney function was even better. So it's frustrating for me too, because I'm not a medical doctor. So when I create these protocols, you know, the conventional doctors that look at me or look at the protocol go, this is not possible. This can't work. You know, there's no natural way to help the kidneys. And sure enough, it works. So well, I've battled the same frustration.
It is. It's frustrating when you are in that situation, isn't it? Of you know, I haven't talked a lot about mold in the book, but I do talk about all the toxins that can affect the cardiovascular system, the lining, the glycocalyx, the endothelium. And discuss why chronic kidney disease is just a different manifestation of cardiovascular disease. It's just that it's affecting the smaller blood vessels. You know, and then you have other things where people get, you know, infection in their gums. And then you say, well, you realize that infection in your gums leads to cardiovascular disease. And doctors just go, what, you know, what are you talking about?
I want to hit some of these other crazy things here in the book too. So, when it comes to lupus,
yeah,
a non-fatal, this would just be considered a stroke. Is that right? A or is that a heart attack?
No, a heart attack is a myocardial infarction.
Mm-hmm.
Myocardium being heart muscle, so infarction meaning it means death, but they don't actually die. A cerebral infarction is in your brain, so your brain's called your cerebrum. So a cerebral infarction is a stroke, although you can have bleeding in your brain, and that's also a stroke. And a myocardial infarction is called by most people a heart attack.
Basically, these numbers go way up. I mean, you write here that if you have lupus, you're 910% more likely to have a non-fatal heart attack, and then an actual death due to the coronary heart disease, 1600% increase if you've got lupus.
Yeah.
And death due to stroke, 690% increase. And then the increase of death from coronary vascular disease in younger women can reach 4,900% if they've got lupus. And this is why it's so much, there's so much emphasis that I place on trying to get people's diets dialed in. I see so many people just eating massive amounts of gluten and grains and high carbohydrates and processed foods. It's tearing up their gut. We see lots of gut inflammation. We see the autoimmune diseases get worse. And so a lot of people just look at lupus and they go, oh, I just have this rash on my face. But then when I read this, I'm like, holy smokes. I mean, you're a ticking time bomb, it sounds like.
Yeah, one of the things with lupus, I mean, it is inflammatory. There's an awful lot of what they call vasculitis diseases. Itis just means inflammation, and vascular obviously just means your vascular system, your blood vessels. So vasculitis is a very damaging thing, because obviously it means the lining of your blood vessels essentially is being damaged. With lupus, you have a condition called, all membranes of all your cells are made up of a thing called phospholipids, which is a lipid with a phosphate, and it's just an interlocking kind of molecule that makes up your cell membranes. So you have a thing called antiphospholipid syndrome that is associated with lupus. So obviously, if you've got antiphospholipid syndrome, that means your body is attacking the membranes of your cells, and especially in your blood vessels. So you can imagine the havoc that is being you know, people get a rash on their face and say, oh, I've just got a rash on my face. What do you think the rash is? This is your blood vessels being inflamed. And it's not just happening in your face. It's happening all around your body. So it's not exactly surprising that that is going to cause a lot of problems within, you know, the lining of your blood vessels are being damaged. The glycocalyx is being stripped away. You're getting real damage going on around your body. Lupus is not the only one. There is actually a syndrome called antiphospholipid syndrome itself, and which again hardly anyone has ever heard of. But if you've got antiphospholipid syndrome, which is also called Hughes disease, and again everyone and most doctors go, what, you know, it affects about 1 in 100 to 1 in 200 people, and it's the cause of, under the age of 50, it's the cause of 50% of all strokes in the entire population under 50.
And that's big numbers, 1 in 200.
I mean, these are huge numbers. They're vast numbers. And so lupus is associated with that. Now, you may remember with COVID, they had this, they called it different things, idiopathic vasculitis syndrome in children, which was caused by the actual COVID virus. And what the COVID virus did was, as you may know, it entered cells through a thing called an A2 receptor, which is all cells have got receptors stuck on the side of them, and an A2 receptor they're found in your lungs and in your vascular system, and angiotensin 2, which is a hormone, links onto that and causes blood vessels to do various things. But that was the way that COVID gained entry into cells, because if you didn't have an A2 receptor, the COVID virus couldn't get into a cell because there was no lock and key mechanism. It was fended off. So the commonest place to have A2 receptors is obviously lungs and the rest of your, and also within your heart and in the myocardial cells and the pericardial cells, very high level of A2 receptors. So this is where COVID went and invaded cells. Now, when that happens, the body doesn't like things invading cells. It sends off the white cells and the antibodies and everything to attack these cells and kill them. And the cell itself sends out a signal saying, I'm being attacked by a virus. You must come and kill me because I don't want to spread it elsewhere. So you then got, essentially, with COVID, you had this, what they call the cytokine storm, because these chemical messengers that the cells send out to say, please attack and kill me, are called cytokines. There's many of them, hundreds, and how many, I have no idea. So if you remember with COVID, you got the cytokine storm. Well, you may have heard of this, I don't know.
Yes,
the cytokine storm was, there was a hell of a lot of cytokines out in the body going, kill me, kill me, kill me. And the immune system was going, okay, I'll come and kill you. And of course, the problem with that is it caused blood clotting all over the place, because a part of the immune system and the blood clotting system at one time, a billion years ago, were the same thing. And they're closely linked together. If the immune system kicks off, it triggers the blood clotting system. In part, that traps viruses and bacteria and mold and everything. It stops it from spreading. So blood clots form around nasty things and kind of entrap them. That used to be the only way that you could get rid of infecting organisms. So if you're an earthworm or a fly or something, that's your immune system. We've developed a secondary set of immune systems as well, but they all work together. So the moment you start triggering a kind of immune system response, you're going to trigger blood clotting at the same time. These two things happen simultaneously. And so when we look at COVID, you see the whole system coming together, or, you know, immune system, cytokines, blood clotting, bang. And you also see that with sepsis, which no one seemed to know existed until about 15 years ago, and now everybody's dying of it. But with sepsis, what happens is that bacteria get into your bloodstream, they start multiplying there, and they release what they call exotoxins. And exotoxin just means external, and toxin just means toxin. So the bacteria start producing these waste products, which are exotoxins. They, first of all, attack the glycocalyx and the endothelium in all your blood vessels. That triggers damage to the blood vessels. That triggers blood clotting. And what kills you with sepsis is that disseminated intravascular coagulation, which basically means lots and lots of little blood clots all around your body. And so your organs start to die, your fingers die, your nose falls off, your ears fall off. So it's all the same thing. And although people look at it and go, they don't seem to have made these connections, if you like, which is vasculitis, inflammation, blood clotting, immune system. They're all working around here all together, doing very much the same thing. And it's all damage to your blood vessels. And that triggers blood clotting, and the blood clotting, if there's big blood clot in one of your arteries in your heart, that's a heart attack. You got a big one in your neck, it travels up into your brain, that's a stroke. So it's really all the same process that's going on everywhere. But there are so many different things that can trigger it. I mean, you're saying mold. Yes, mold can trigger damage to blood vessels. Bacterial toxins can do it. Viruses can do it. Blood sugar can do it. You know, air pollution can do it. Smoking can do it. Vasculitis from antiphospholipid syndrome. There's just a huge number of things that can do damage to your blood vessels. And they all, in the end, it's the same process, but it's just an awful lot of different things. And if they all start working together, so if you smoke and you've got diabetes and you've got air pollution and you've got stress and all the stress hormones are causing problems, and then you get a bacterial or viral infection, that's kind of going to get you. And all of these things, they're very different things. So somebody can have a heart attack or a stroke and have five factors working to do that. And it could be a completely different five factors to somebody else. So you can look at them and say, how did that person have a heart attack? They didn't smoke. They didn't this, they didn't, you know, you always get that, don't you? They did anything wrong in their lives. Well, actually, you don't know what they did wrong because you've never measured any of these things. You don't actually know what was happening in this person. You're just assuming that the things we're told about cholesterol, which is just nonsense. That's about the only one thing I would say does not cause heart disease. All right? Out of all these factors, forget cholesterol. It's completely irrelevant. But all these other things, you don't know which of those things they had. You don't know they had lead toxicity. Who measured their lead levels in their bloody body? No one. You know, you don't know if they have mold or periodontitis. So when people say, oh, they never did anything wrong, I say, well, they must have done something wrong because they're dead. and they died of a heart attack. And therefore, there was something going wrong. You just don't know what it was.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And they go, well, it's just the frustration levels, as you can tell. If frustration was to kill you from heart disease, I would have died 30 years ago. Okay.
Well, that's good to know frustration won't kill you. I mean, anger will. We certainly read about that. You wrote about that in the book. Now, yeah, I mean, I see that all the time, especially here in the U.S. media. You know, if someone dies of a heart attack, you know, now I think it's linked to probably the injections. It's linked to long-term viral issues, long-haul syndrome. But that's the common thing. It's they didn't smoke, they didn't drink. It's like, okay, great. 2 out of 200 factors were not a factor in this heart disease or this heart attack, you know. Great job, but that doesn't get you out of the woods here. And everything looks fine if you're not looking in the right places.
Yes.
And that's what we're seeing too. I'm sure it's the same in the UK because I have a lot of clients in the UK that complain of the medical system there. But, you know, the blood work sucks. It's not comprehensive enough. And so everyone gets told they're fine and they're not fine and they don't feel fine. So,
yes.
And I'm glad you brought up sepsis as well. So I don't know if you know of this guy, but Dr. Paul Merrick, have you heard of him? He's from Canada,
Paul Merrick,
I believe.
Yeah. Am I spoken to?
So he's he's part of like the kind of the COVID frontline doctors, and so he got I don't want to say mega famous, but at least in the medical community, he calls it the Merrick protocol for sepsis, and it works great.
IV
vitamin C. 1.5 grams, and then hydrocortisone. He does a little bit of then thiamine, so B1. Yeah. So that was like his sepsis protocol. So that's I'm glad that you brought that up. And also, you know, I think we're already starting to see like massive cancer rates and all that. But what are you picturing for maybe the next 5 years or so? I mean, all the people that got the injection, we're seeing that. I talked to Dr. Pierre Corey. He's an MD, ICU lung doctor. He has looked into the research on the injections and he's like, hey, we don't know when this mRNA tells the body to stop producing spike protein. And I'm like, does anybody know that? So, I mean, what do you think in the next 5 years? Are we just going to continue to see these like thrombotic episodes?
I'd have to say, I have no idea when that switch off occurs or how long it fires for. But I mean, as you know, you've got to be so careful when you talk about this area.
Sure,
otherwise, the dementors come and suck your life out of your body.
That's right.
And accuse you of killing everybody on the planet Earth, including the species on other planets we haven't even heard of. You're killing
them
too.
That's right. And
you know nothing, and you're stupid, and you're ignorant, and you blah, blah, blah. Don't worry. Listen, I wrote very early on. In fact, I was writing one of the chapters on vasculitis and the effect of Kawasaki's disease and other things that cause vasculitis when COVID hit. And people were saying, oh, we've got this strange thing that's causing blood clots. And how can this possibly be? And I'm thinking, well, you know exactly how it can be. It's very obvious.
Yeah.
You know, influenza A and B can both cause blood clotting and heart attacks through the same processes. But yes, I started writing about it and then I shut up because it just wasn't worth the pain of being attacked by everybody that moved. Was saying, well, we know that the spike protein triggers blood clotting. In fact, that's kind of, we just knew that right very early on. And so you're producing a substance that goes into the cell, finds a ribosome and says, please make as many spike proteins as you can and stop doing everything else. And then what? And the argument at that point was, well, it never enters the bloodstream. These spike proteins, well, what? They just stay inside the cell, in which case they couldn't achieve anything because the immune system would never come across them. So they had to leave the cell somehow, well, they do. And therefore, they had to start floating around in the bloodstream, which they do. And if they're a spike protein, they're going to go and find a receptor, an A2 receptor around a place and stick to it because that's what they do. And once they've done that, then they're going to cause blood clots around the body. We know all these things. I mean, even the mainstream medicine sort of knows all these things. Yeah. And they refuse to join the dots, which is you are making the body make a protein that will go to cells and trigger the immune system to either kill the cell to which they're attached or create a blood clot or both. I mean, that's what's going to happen. That's why, you know, COVID itself causes blood clots. And you're making this stuff. And you're making the body make this stuff. Yeah. And you're saying it doesn't cause blood clots. And I'm going, well, in that case, everything we know about everything is wrong. So, you know, or they say, oh, it doesn't leave the cells. At one point they said, remember, the virus stays in the shoulder muscle. Mm-hmm. Like, what? It doesn't hit. They managed to avoid all the capillaries and arterioles and all the vascular system in the shoulder and just go straight into the cells. It must be a very small and sharp needle. It just goes into the cell and then comes back out again, goes into another cell. And then these cells in the shoulder make proteins, but they never enter the bloodstream. Well, then how does the immune system ever encounter it? So how do you trigger any immune response if the immune system can't actually ever get to it, find it, and then manufacture antibodies to it? Then that doesn't work either. So it's like, it's almost like, in order to say the mRNA vaccines cannot cause blood clotting, it's to deny every step of the process that has to happen for it to work in the first place.
Yeah.
So you're speaking to people and going, well, how do you think vaccination works? It works because the immune system comes across some form or part, a deuterated part of a virus, vaccine, or whatever. And then once it's attached itself to it, it goes back to the dendritic cells and the lymph nodes, and then the T cells start, and the B cells all go into operation. And what you're saying is none of that actually happens when we vaccinate people with mRNA. So how does it work then? You know,
I know. It's coming
so,
out.
So you're saying, you know, the question is, does it then attenuate? Does the body get, does the cells just say, well, I've made enough mRNA, thank you very much. I'm going to stop. I've made enough spike protein, thank you very much. I'm not going to pay any more attention to the mRNA itself. When does it wear out? I have no idea. I just don't know. I can't believe, or the cells that are producing it get attacked by the immune system because they don't like cells sticking spike proteins into the body very much. So I suspect it lasts for weeks or months. I don't think it would continue beyond that point. But if you keep revaccinating people, well, yes. But if you stop vaccinating people, I would imagine that process just dies out after some amount of time, which is probably not that long. That's my uninformed guesstimate of this system because I don't really know.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's coming out slowly in the US media, but it's little and it's like a 1 minute segment. And then they quickly move on to an advertisement for, you know, some magical immune suppressing drug. And they show this woman at a birthday party with her son and she's having a great time. You know, like that's how quickly it just kind of gets dusted on here, at least in the US media.
Well, it's quite, I sometimes use the matrix as my example. Do you want to take the blue pill or the red pill? Do you want to believe everything is perfect in a shiny world, or do you want to see the world as it is? And those people who've taken the red pill recognize each other, but I don't know if it's made them any happier done it. But
agreed. But let's talk about some more fun things here. So
yeah,
I appreciate your insight on that. And vitamin C. I love vitamin C. I take an electrolyte formula with vitamin C every day. I try to give my kids taking it. It's amazing the role that vitamin C plays all in this. And it's such a cheap compound and widely available. And you write a really great part. I mean, in several parts of the book, you write about this issue of scurvy, which would be obviously the extreme manifestation of a vitamin C deficiency. But even in a non-scurvy case, you can still develop issues here. And so I just wanted to read a piece of it here, which is that if you were to find yourself unable to get sufficient vitamin C, which just a little pretext to this for folks listening and then for you also, I don't know exactly how accurate it is, but I've run thousands of these tests, urine organic acids test, where we measure all sorts of vitamins, B6, B12, we can measure B3. We can measure vitamin C. I would say 90 out of 100 people that I measure, they have vitamin C deficiency. And I don't know if there's better or other ways to measure it, but at least organic acids testing, it seems to be pretty well validated. There's a lab out of the US here in Canada who's done this for 20, 30 years. They've been doing organic acids testing. I've run other companies that also sell organic acids to try and compare, and they seem to match up across the labs measuring the urine that almost everyone is low in vitamin C. And you discuss in the book how humans are one of the poor creatures, the misfortunate creatures that we cannot synthesize our own vitamin C, and how this could potentially lead to our detriment. So that's the pretext. But then back into the book here, you say here that if you're unable to get sufficient vitamin C, nature came up with a patch to help keep you alive until you could get a hold of it again. And this patch, basically, it sounds like you start to develop an issue in the artery wall because you have this plug. Can you explain that? Break that whole vitamin C thing down. What's happening in the deficiency case?
I love the vitamin C story. It's sort of it's so elegant. It was first proposed by Linus Pauling and another guy called Matthias Rath, who unfortunately has a bad reputation for various things, but I think he did some amazing work. Well, essentially, animals that can't synthesize vitamin C have what's called a lipoprotein, which is, you know, LDL, low density lipoprotein, bad cholesterol. The lipoprotein, there's another lipoprotein, which is LDL, bad lipoprotein, with an extra protein attached to it called apolipoprotein A. And it's stuck to the side of it. It floats around in your bloodstream. You have about a sixth of the amount of LDL you have as LPA. It's called LPA. And people go, we don't know what this does. We don't know what this does. We have no idea why it's here. We don't know what it is. All right. It's gaining a bit more traction now. But essentially what happens is if you have a damaged area of your artery, now step back again. One of the things that vitamin C does is it helps the body to synthesize collagen, which is like the reinforced steel bars in concrete. If you don't have enough collagen in your being synthesized, your body starts to break down. And that's really what happens in scurvy. One of the first things that start to break down are your blood vessels. So your blood vessels start to crack, you start to bleed. So one of the first symptoms of scurvy is bleeding gums. That's a clinical sign. Obviously, there's bleeding going on around in the rest of your body. Now, the first thing that would happen then is you obviously would bleed to death. And that would be your first mechanism of death with scurvy. But the LPA, which is the LDL with this extra protein attached, seeks out areas of damage and cracks, sticks to it and causes a patch, if you like. And that patch is actually, which is a good thing in scurvy, because it keeps you alive so you don't bleed to death as quickly as you otherwise would. The problem with it is it's very difficult to remove because this protein, which is called apolipoprotein A, sorry to be this is all technical, is the same protein as another protein called plasminogen. This the problem with it, I like it's an elegant story, but you can lose people quite quickly. So plasminogen is incorporated into all blood clots as they form. And you trigger plasminogen to form. There's a thing called plasminogen activator, tissue plasminogen activator, which is used in people having strokes and heart attacks. You give it to people, and it turns plasminogen into plasmin. And plasmin is an enzyme which breaks down fibrin, which is a thing that holds blood clots together. So plasminogen goes to plasmin. Plasmin breaks down blood clots. So therefore, if you had a blocked artery, for whatever reason, and you triggered plasminogen into plasmin, the plasmin would split the blood clot apart, the blood clot would be blown apart, and the blood supply would be reestablished. All right. However, if you've got a lot of ALPA, an apolipoprotein A, which is identical to plasminogen except for a different fold of the protein at the end, it blocks the action of tissue plasminogen activator. It stops plasminogen being turned to plasmin, and so the blood clots that are made with a high proportion of LPA cannot be broken apart. So they stick and they stay and they don't move. And that is a good thing if you've got scurvy. It is not a good thing is obviously if you've damaged a part of your artery or a blood vessel and you've got LPA has formed on top of that area of denuded artery where it could be cracked or bleeding, and it will stick there and it really won't move, or it's much more difficult to remove. All right. So people with a high LPA level have a much higher risk of dying of heart disease because the blood clots that form when they form are very difficult to shift. Now, what Linus Pauling said was, well, if you take lots of vitamin C, you stop the damage to the blood vessels. Obviously, you get less cracking and less blood clots formed, and the LPA doesn't actually have to do anything because you haven't got so much damage to your artery wall. Also, vitamin C is hugely important in protecting endothelial cells. If you have a bacterial or viral infection, the endothelial cells start burning through their vitamin C supplies very quickly to keep their immune and their function going. And so when you've got an infection, like a flu or a bacterial infection, that's when you really need to start taking high doses of vitamin C, because your body starts to take your reserves and just chops through them. So having a high dose of vitamin C is very important, because it stops this sort of arterial and vein damage from occurring. So yes, vitamin C is not, LPA doesn't cause heart disease, and it doesn't cause damage, and it doesn't cause problem for the glycocalyx or the endothelial cells. What it does do is, when a blood clot forms, LPA forms a really difficult to shift clot. Now, what Matthias Rath did was he looked at people who'd had bypasses, coronary artery bypasses, and they take a bit of the artery out and then they chuck it away. What they do, I'm not entirely sure what they do with it. And what he did was, he said, right, well, I'd like to have a look at these, arteries you've taken out. And he stained them, right, for this form of protein, the apolipoprotein A protein, which most people never look for. It's never really looked for, right? And what he found is that all these areas where the coronary arteries were full of plaque and damage had a very high concentration of this apolipoprotein A in them, right? Which means that the lipoprotein that they were finding was not LDL, low density lipoprotein, bad cholesterol. What they were actually finding was LPA. And you can't tell the difference between LPA and LDL unless you stain for this protein. Because unless you do, you don't know it's there. So when you stain for it, you find it's there. So actually, weirdly and interestingly, there is a lipoprotein which increases the risk of heart disease. And it's kind of the evil twin of LDL, all right? But people have looked at the LDL in plaques and said, oh, it's terrible, it's found in plaques and it must be causing heart disease. And you go, it's not LDL, it's LPA. You're looking at the wrong thing. You are looking at the wrong thing. Or you're looking at the right thing, but you're not actually recognizing it for what it is. So the whole story about vitamin C and LPA and LDL is a fascinating story of grabbing hold of the wrong culprit, claiming it's causing something when it didn't and doesn't. And this is another frustration. It's like, can you not understand that what you're looking at is not LDL, it's LPA? But if you never look for this protein, you will never know you're looking at LPA. You think you're looking at LDL. It's going, yes, but we know LPA, lipoprotein A with the apolipoprotein attached. We know that's what it does. But if you go onto the internet and start looking at LPA, and they go, oh yes, we know that apolipoprotein A and plasminogen are virtually identical in amino acid structure, but it has a slightly different folding mechanism at the end called the kringle. But we don't actually know what it does. You do know what it does. Why would the body have a large amount of this stuff floating around in it that is identical to plasminogen, and its only function is to stop plasminogen being converted to plasmin to break down clots? Why do you think the body does that? Because for fun. And it just coincidentally that you have this exact same thing in the animals that don't produce or are capable of synthesizing vitamin C, one of which is guinea pigs. And there was a man who did experiments on guinea pigs, and he lowered the vitamin C levels to zero by not giving them any vitamin C. They all developed, these guinea pigs developed atherosclerotic plaques in their arteries very quickly. He then gave them back vitamin C and the plaques disappeared.
That's right. Amazing. So let me ask you this then.
Yeah.
If you were to look at blood work, so I ran some numbers just over the last few years. I'm just curious, if you look at, say, my lipoprotein A, yeah, I measured
this. Lipoprotein A is not apolipoprotein A. It's not okay, the same thing.
So there's the apolipoprotein B.
Yeah, apolipoprotein B, or apolipoprotein B100, is a protein that's attached to the side of LDL, so-called bad cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
It's also attached to the side of triglycerides, or very low-density lipoproteins. That is a different protein. The thing you're calling there apolipoprotein or A is not the same thing as I'm talking about, all right?
I see. I wish that's I had the A. Looks like I don't have it.
I guess. Don't worry.
I just wonder, is this deliberately complicating or not, you know? It is.
Of course it is, because people go, you're talking about apolipoprotein A and saying it's a bad thing, and we're all told that lipoprotein A is a good thing. Yes, it's a different protein, you idiots. It's not the same thing. Stop trying to confuse everybody. I mean, the terminology here is, I mean, the lipoprotein A there is a lipoprotein that's attached to high-density lipoproteins, which are supposed to be good for you, all right? And that's a way of saying you have good cholesterol, high levels of good cholesterol, okay? That's not the same as apolipoprotein A, although, to be frank, it sounds exactly the same, but it's completely different.
Yeah, what
I'm another problem you have is just the terminology is incomprehensibly stupid.
Yeah, right?
I mean, I should call it apolipoprotein Z, and then we would know it's not A. And yeah, there's two A's, one's good, one's bad. B is bad. Oh, for God's sake, it's just ridiculous, all right?
Well, here's what's hard, though, is these conventional labs are using these reference ranges to where I get flagged high, high, high. Even if I'm eating organic meats, pastured butter, I'm doing relatively low carb, I'm doing fruits and berries, you could look at my numbers and everything's flagged. And a conventional doctor would look at me and say, like, you need a statin. Like, my total cholesterol as of this month was a 271.
271, right.
Yes.
Well, in the UK, we use millimoles per liter, which is the proper way of doing things. So 271 is high. Well, no, I refuse to use that word. It's high. It's a bit like saying, well, you know, someone who's 6'4" should be made to be 5'8" because they're too tall. They're suffering from tallness. No one says that. Your cholesterol level is, it doesn't cause heart disease. However, if you have a high triglyceride, I don't know if they use that terminology in the state.
They do.
VLDL level, all right? Non-LDL, whatever, however you define. This is the problem we've got. It started out as you had a cholesterol level. Of course, you don't actually have any cholesterol in your blood. There's no cholesterol floating free in your bloodstream. It's all carried in lipoproteins, which are small spheres. Of those, you have chylomicrons, you have very low-density lipoproteins, you have intermediate-density lipoproteins, you have low-density lipoproteins, and you have high-density lipoproteins, all right? Now, they all contain cholesterol, they all contain fats, but they are not cholesterol and they are not fat, but they just contain these things, all right? So it has been decreed that if your HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, which is the smallest of them all, is low, and the very low-density lipoprotein, which is sometimes called triglyceride level, which, of course, is nonsense because it carries triglycerides, is high. You have a high VLDL or triglyceride to HDL ratio, and that is a bad thing, all right? Now, the reason why that's a bad thing is because that is the exact form of lipoproteins that you see in diabetes. All right.
So sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I want people to know if they're going to run an advanced cholesterol, maybe some extra lipid panel, what should they even pay attention to and what should they disregard? So you're saying the one that is worth paying attention to is a cholesterol to HDL ratio?
Yes. Either total cholesterol HDL ratio or VLDL or triglyceride level HDL ratio. Now, HDL does not contain apolipoprotein B100, right? So if you have a high and they say high apolipoprotein A level, that tends to mean you've also got a lot of HDL kicking around, all right? But that, again, these are just the proteins attached to these lipoproteins are all, have got various proteins attached stuff on the side of them, which allows them then to function. So in the LDL, which is the bad cholesterol molecule, I hate the word bad cholesterol, it's just stupid and unscientific. Anyway, LDL has apolipoprotein B100. That's the protein attached to it, as others. And that's the one that then links to an LDL receptor in a cell. So that's the way that the LDL receptor knows what this is. So it's a lock and key system. So the LDL comes along, floats around in the body. It's got this B100 sticking out the side of it, a receptor sticking out of a cell. It recognizes the B100. The LDL sticks to the receptor, and then the entire receptor plus the LDL is dragged into the cell. And that's how those systems work, all right? So if you don't have the B100 attached to you, then the receptor is not going to recognize you, all right? So that's what it's there for, all right? So the other lipoproteins are so that the liver recognizes that you're a thing, cells recognize you're another thing, and then, in fact, the lipoproteins themselves transfer cholesterol and lipids across from each other and to each other, and they recognize each other by these protein linkages as well. So they're all floating around in the blood and are transferring cholesterol and lipoproteins and fats amongst them, and sometimes the entire protein thing is transferred. So if you have a high VLDL, which is the stuff the liver produces level, the HDL comes along and transfers proteins to it, and often then they just disappear. Effectively, they just disintegrate, or I'm not quite sure exactly if they disintegrate. So if your liver's producing a lot of fat and cholesterol and churning out what they call these VLDL molecules, there will be more of those in the system, and automatically there'll be less HDL. And that is what happens when you've got insulin resistance and or type 2 diabetes, because that's how the system now works. So what happens is the total cholesterol level is this VLDL plus LDL level added together in some places and not in others versus the HDL. And when that ratio becomes bad, what that means is you've got diabetes, right? Or you may not know it, or you've got fatty liver. Because that is how the body responds. And all that's telling is we know that diabetes causes heart disease. But what people have said is, that means these things cause diabetes. No, this is the yellow fingers and lung cancer and smoking argument, which I don't know if you're familiar with, which is that people with yellow fingers are more likely to die of lung cancer. Yes, of course they are. Why do people have yellow fingers? Because they smoke. It's not the yellow fingers that's causing the lung cancer, you idiot. It's the smoking, all right? So when you have a high total cholesterol to HDL ratio, it's not that that's killing you with heart disease. It's the fact that it's telling you you've got diabetes. And it's the diabetes that's killing you. And if you sort the diabetes out, you reduce the carbohydrate consumption, and you do high-intensity exercise, that ratio will normalize. The overall total cholesterol levels may stay exactly the same if you measure everything and add it together. What you've done is you've changed the ratios. So we're in a world of, I said, if frustration killed you, I would be dead, all right? I mean, I would have exploded, because you're trying to speak to people and going, listen, this is how the body works. You go and speak to 100, I'll guarantee this, go and speak to 1,000 doctors, all right? And I ask them this question, where does LDL come from? Where does low density, like the deadly or disease causing, where, and the thing that statins lower, where does LDL come from, all right? Now, if you find one doctor that knows the answer to that question, I'll fall off my chair in amazement. I will fall off my chair in amazement, all right? No doctors know any of this stuff at all. All right. It's like, but they know it's just amazing. And so where does LDL come from? Where does low density lipoprotein, bad cholesterol, the thing you lower with statins that stops heart disease from happening, where does it come from? It comes from very low density lipoprotein. Very low density lipoprotein is produced in the liver. And it comes out of the liver and it floats around the body, losing fats, all right, and shrinks down in size. At first, it becomes an intermediate density lipoprotein. Then it becomes a low density lipoprotein. And then the vast, vast 99.9% of that is taken back into the liver and taken out of the circulation. A very small amount continues to float around in the body, and cells that need cholesterol stick out a receptor and say, can I have some cholesterol from the LDL molecules?
Let me ask you this, because this is what people want to know at the end of the day. What else should they care about? Should they care about particle numbers? Should they care about particle size? You hear so much about that now, the small versus medium, their LDL peak size. Like, is that really worth running? Like, if you're going to run a cholesterol profile or a panel on somebody, is it going to include all these extra fancy biomarkers?
Well,
or are you
really
going to change their treatment plan?
They can now do it, you know. When they go about particle numbers, like, well, particle numbers are just the number of particles. That means just the number of LDL, IDL, HDL, the number of things that are in your bloodstream. There's no difference between that and it's just a different way of defining it, of saying what these things are, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just a different way of measuring them. If you measure your apolipoprotein B100 level, big deal. That just tells you the number of VLDL and IDL and LDL molecules floating around in your bloodstream. Well, that's no different than knowing the level of those things in your bloodstream. And then you've got small dense LDL and light fluffy LDL.
That's but, right.
I mean, what are you talking about? This is just utter. If you've got an airplane and it's under attack from missiles and it releases a little aluminium. What's it called? Chaff.
The flares, yeah.
Flares and chaff. So the missile misses, all right? Because the cholesterol hypothesis started out as you eat too much cholesterol, your blood cholesterol goes up, it's absorbed into the arteries, and you die, right? That was the original cholesterol hypothesis. Ansel Keys, 1948. Mm-hmm. He himself discovered that if you eat cholesterol, it makes no difference to your cholesterol level. And so the hypothesis changed to no, it's saturated fat that raises your cholesterol. How does it do that? He had no explanation for it, and it doesn't. And then they at that time, he didn't even know there were different lipoproteins. He didn't know there was IDL and VLDL and HDL and LDL. There was just stuff that lipoproteins, and he said, you've got this many. So he had no idea there was different types of lipoproteins initially. And so then they said, oh, well, let's find people who've got high LDL levels, and they don't have high rates of heart disease. You can find many populations like this. Oh, well, it's not the LDL that kills you. It's the ratio of LDL to HDL. Because what HDL does is it sucks cholesterol out of plaques and sends it back to the liver, and therefore it keeps you well. This is just another nonsense idea that is just ridiculous. And so they changed it from, well, it's not LDL, it's a LDL to HDL ratio. And then they found a population. I'll briefly tell you a little story. There was a population in a village in Italy near to Milan, which had a very, very low HDL level. It was about a quarter of normal or whatever. No cases of heart disease in this population. So they said, oh, my goodness, why is this? They said, oh, well, they've got HDL that's particularly protective against heart disease, all right? And it's this specific protein that... And so they made it in a lab, and they called ApoA Milano 1, right? And they injected ApoA Milano 1 into people's arteries and said, oh, my God, look, we can see the plaques are disappearing in front of our very eyes, okay? And then the company that developed this sold it to Pfizer for $1 billion, okay? And Pfizer then went, well, we've got this fantastic thing, and we can cure heart disease by injecting ApoA 1 Milano into people's arteries. And guess what? It had no effect whatsoever. So the whole drug just disappeared and died. All right. Somebody made $1 billion. Good for them. Well done. You know. I wouldn't name names because I'll get sued for libel. They developed another series of drugs about 20 years ago, which raised HDL levels by about 120%, lowered LDL levels, the bad cholesterol, by about 50%. They were called the satrapibs. There was four of them. And four different pharmaceutical companies produced satrapibs and spent billions of dollars researching these. They should have been more effective than statins because they lowered LDL to a greater degree and raised HDL to a massive degree. All right. And the first of these, torsatrapib, increased the risk of cardiovascular disease by 55%. So they pulled it from the market. overall, none of them achieved anything at all. None of them did anything whatsoever. So you had these really high HDL levels, you had these really low LDL levels, and nothing happened. And they were all pooled and they spent billions. You've never heard of them. No one outside of a very small group of people, including me, because I look at this stuff, has ever heard of them, and they died a death. Now, if you want an experiment to disprove the cholesterol hypothesis or the HDL hypothesis or the particle number or particle size hypothesis, you've got four big randomized controlled trials that showed nothing. And then they came along with the new drugs that are called PCSK9 inhibitors, which you've probably heard of, which reduce LDL levels by about 70%. Okay. And what effect did they have on cardiovascular mortality? Now, they've been claimed to have had success, all right? But what effect did they have on overall or cardiovascular mortality? The answer is none, nothing. They've achieved nothing. And I was just recently looking at the Fourier study, which was the first one to come out. It lowered LDL by 60%, all right? And the total mortality rate was higher in the people who took the drug, not statistically significant, okay? You hear nothing of this, do you?
No, I don't know. I didn't look that deep into it.
No. Well, I do.
I'm glad you do.
I spend my time looking at papers and going, what the bloody hell has happened here? All
right. I look at papers. I just haven't looked at those. But here's what I want to get to, because we do got to wrap up, but we could easily you're fine. We could easily do a whole nother hour on this. But here are some of your favorite things. And so I want to just list off a few of these favorite things, and then obviously we'll link to the book. I want people to check this out because, you know, it's 300 pages of just mind-blowing things, and this is called The Clot Thickens. Okay, that's what you all are looking for, Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, The Clot Thickens. So here's some of his favorite things. There are a lot of different mechanisms involved. Nitric oxide is a big one. Increased sun exposure, amazing. Yeah. Increased arginine and citrulline, amazing. Dark chocolate, amazing. Meat, animal organs, especially liver. I love that. So we'll save the rest for people to check out the book. But those are at least a few of the things that I've personally felt the difference. Just living in Florida, I have an abundant amount of sunshine, and I can tell you a significant difference with the sun exposure, how that's increasing nitric oxide, how that's helping to regulate blood pressure, and ultimately how that is helping with my cardiovascular health. So it's a great book, and man, we can do a whole nother hour another time if you'd like.
Well, maybe. I do get carried away. I'm sorry.
No, you don't need to be sorry at all. And also, we want to leave people with your website as well. Could you just give us your resources?
DrMalcolmKendrick.org. I have been a wee bit silent on it recently because there's a major court case going on in the UK where I am actually suing Associated Newspapers and various other people for libel for stating that because I'm critical of statins and cholesterol lowering, that I've caused thousands of people to die. So I am, whilst that case is going on, I'm kind of, the lawyers are telling me to keep my trap shut. I have been keeping my trap shut. So once that's finished, there is an awful lot of stuff there. I've written about 96 articles on what causes heart disease, which sort of turned into this book. And there's a lot of other stuff there, but I haven't been updating it much recently, but I will be getting back to it soon. DrMalcolmKendrick.org. It's a WordPress thing.
Awesome. Well, we'll link to that. And then you have your book here, The Clot Thickens. So hopefully people will support you that way and get a copy of it. And man, it's a true pleasure. Thank you for, you know, pulling this stuff out of the literature, putting it into a book for people to try and understand and have good takeaways from. You know, there's a lot of good takeaways here that are not complicated. So I want to say thank you for that.
Thank you. I enjoyed the chat.
All right. That show obviously needed to be like 2 hours, but if you made it to the end, thank you so much. You know, sometimes you want to let these people just riff. You don't want to necessarily like steer them too away from where they're going to go, because sometimes the free-flowing thought reveals a lot of golden nuggets. But obviously, we need more time with that guy. Man, there's so much to unpack there. So hope you enjoyed it. If you want to reach out clinically, evanbrand.com has all the details. I'd be happy to work with you and help you on a one-on-one basis. betterbellycourse.com. You can go there, learn how to take your health into your own hands. I'm obviously here to hold your hand, and I would love the opportunity to help you on a one-on-one basis. I do that 1,000+ times a year, But there's so many smart people like you listening to this show that have a lot of basic functional medicine, nutrition knowledge. They just need a little bit of guidance and direction about how to interpret their labs. And that's what Better Belly Course teaches you. It teaches you what I'm doing clinically behind the scenes. I've essentially cloned myself, put it into this program so you can look at these labs and then you can piece together a protocol that makes sense, that is very effective and is not going to break the bank. So that's betterbellycourse.com. I would love to have you in there. I'm debating switching to some sort of like a membership model because I have so many courses and it's quite an investment for people to get into all of them. The Heal My Fatigue, that is my other incredible course, healmyfatigue.com. That's where I teach you about chronic fatigue. If you've been diagnosed with chronic fatigue, or maybe you have long haul syndrome from the virus or the injection, healmyfatigue.com. You'll be able to access all of my modules on stealth infections, mold, parasites, histamine intolerance, mold colonization, breast implant illness, H. pylori, just to name a few, and the top six root causes of fatigue. So that's an incredible course. That's just another one-time payment that you pay to get access to that. And that is even cheaper than Better Belly. So if you're struggling with fatigue, consider that. I'd love the opportunity to help you and get you enrolled into that class as well. All right, this is Evan Brand signing out. Get some electrolytes in your system. Don't sweat them all out. If you do, just replenish. You can do them every day. A scoop a day is probably as much as you need. If you're really constipated, you could do more, but you know, too much vitamin C is going to move anybody's bowel. So don't cause yourself diarrhea by overdosing on the electrolytes. We do have a hefty dose of vitamin C in there, but I'd say one scoop a day is a perfect sweet spot for most people. Take good care of yourself. I'll catch you soon. Bye-bye.